What if I told you that a school admitting fewer than maybe 2,100 incoming freshmen a year is sitting on a bank account larger than the total economic output of several sovereign nations?
Yeah, it sounds like an exaggeration, but it's really not.
Right. I mean, when you walk past a historic building, maybe it's an old bank or a courthouse or a cathedral, it's incredibly easy to just see the stone.
Oh, absolutely.
You see those heavy oak doors, the ivy growing up the brick, and you naturally think, well, that's just a monument to the past. It feels completely static, unmoving.
Yeah, it looks like a museum exhibit. We tend to look at sheer age and, well, mistake it for simple, passive endurance. We assume these places just stand there while history happens around them.
Exactly. But what if, instead of a static monument, you were actually looking at a massive, highly engineered particle
A
accelerator?
particle accelerator. I like that.
Like a machine where you drop in raw human talent and capital at one end, and it spins them at incredible speeds to generate pure, concentrated global influence at the other. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking right at you, the listener, because today we are analyzing a comprehensive 2026 analytical report on a globally recognized institution, Harvard University.
And our mission today isn't to take some breezy, admissions campus tour.
Definitely not. We are looking far past the ivy-covered walls to analyze Harvard not just as a school, but as a compounding, self-reinforcing system of global power, capital, and elite network formation. Okay, let's unpack this. We aren't just talking about a college here.
No, not at all.
According to the data in front of us, Harvard is essentially an institutional flywheel. It's this mechanism that continually converts historical prestige into modern, highly tangible influence.
What's fascinating here is that when you break down the actual mechanics of this flywheel, Harvard's competitive moat isn't just about having good professors or high teaching quality.
Right, I mean, education matters.
It matters, obviously. But the true power of the institution is a unique, deeply interacting bundle. It's the extreme, microscopic selection of students, combined with a $56.9 billion endowment and a 400,000-strong global alumni network.
All three working together.
Exactly. If you just had a massive endowment without the selective admissions, you couldn't reproduce this network. And a famous brand without massive research depth would eventually, well, it would decay into a purely historic novelty. The power relies entirely on how these separate layers feed into one another.
So to really understand how this modern powerhouse functions, we have to look at its foundational architecture. Like, how was this machine designed to outlast completely different political, social, and economic eras? Let's take it all the way back to the origins in 1636.
Yeah, the origin story is wild.
It is. And this is one of those great pieces of historical reality that just cracks the mythology. John Harvard didn't actually found the university.
No, he really didn't. He was actually a young Puritan minister who died in 1638. At the time, Massachusetts was barely a functioning colony, right? And this brand new Puritan college was incredibly fragile.
Barely hanging on.
Exactly. Its only real goal was training colonial clergy and a few civic leaders so the colony wouldn't literally collapse when the first generation died off. John Harvard just happened to leave roughly half of his estate and a library of about 400 books to this struggling little project.
It's just 400 books.
Yeah, and the colonial legislature named it after him in 1639, essentially as a thank you for keeping the lights on.
Wow. So it starts as this tiny confessional colonial school, but it obviously doesn't stay there. The source material tracks this fascinating evolution, particularly focusing on President Charles W. Eliot in the late 19th century.
Right, he was the big pivot.
Yeah, he's the one who basically built the blueprint for the modern American research university. He added electives, graduate studies, and pushed for specialized secular knowledge. Then you jump to the post-World War II era, and the scale just goes nuclear.
The federal funding boom.
Exactly. The institution becomes heavily dependent on federal research funding, transforming from a regional elite school into a massive national research conglomerate. But, and this is what gets me, through all of this explosive growth over centuries, the way it is managed is wild to me. It has a highly unusual two-board governance system.
Yeah, it's definitely not your standard corporate structure.
Right. First, you have the Harvard Corporation, which is this tiny fiduciary body dating all the way back to a 1650 charter. And then you have the Board of Overseers, which is a much larger alumni elected review body.
I'm looking at this structure and I have to ask, Is Harvard's governance structured less like a modern Fortune 500 company and more like a two-chamber colonial government?
That's a really good way to picture it, actually.
But I want to push back on the efficiency of this model. Mm-hmm. I mean, why on earth wouldn't an enterprise this massive, with literally billions of dollars on the line, just use a standard CEO and corporate board setup? It seems so clunky.
Well, because corporate agility would actually be a massive liability for an institution like this.
Wait, really? A liability? Yeah. The answer lies in what they're actually trying to optimize. A Fortune 500 company is optimizing for quarterly speed, right? Shareholder returns, quick market pivots. Harvard is optimizing for intergenerational resilience. Let's look at that term you used. A fiduciary body.
Right.
The corporation's legal duty is entirely to the long-term survival and stewardship of the university's assets. By separating that small, heavily insulated fiduciary stewardship from the broader alumni review of the overseers, you build a fortress.
So it's built to be slow.
Exactly. It ensures that no single mega donor, no single populist politician, and no ambitious university president can easily commandeer the institution. It deliberately sacrifices corporate speed to guarantee that the university can hold property, mm-hmm. accumulate legal precedents, and survive across literal centuries without being dismantled every time the national political winds change.
That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, it survived the American Revolution, the Civil War, and the Great Depression with this exact structural friction in place.
Okay, so that deliberate friction in the governance structure allows them to think in centuries, which naturally leads to accumulating massive compounding resources. Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about the actual fuel pouring into this flywheel.
The money.
The money. In fiscal year 2025, Harvard's operating revenue was $6.7 billion. And 37% of that massive operating budget came purely from endowment distributions. Now, the endowment itself sits at $56.9 billion.
Which is just a staggering number.
It is. But our 2026 report makes a crucial kind of counterintuitive distinction here. This endowment is not a single giant checking account.
Right. People always get that wrong.
It is made up of about 14,765 individual, highly specific microfunds. And over 80% of that money is legally restricted by the original donors to very specific purposes. Like, you can't just take money meant for a medieval literature professorship and spend it on a new football stadium.
Legally, you absolutely cannot.
So if over 80% of $57 billion is legally locked up in these restricted funds, is Harvard's massive wealth actually a gilded cage rather than a blank check?
You know, it's easy to see how a university administrator trying to balance a short-term budget might feel caged by those restrictions. But if we look at what that restricted capital actually accomplishes on a macro level, it is the ultimate generator of strategic patience.
Strategic patience?
Yeah. Even with those rigid legal guardrails, that aggregate wealth allows Harvard to play an entirely different game than its peers. It subsidizes highly specialized research, say, in obscure quantum physics or niche humanities, that commercial markets simply will never fund.
Because there's no immediate ROI.
Exactly. And more importantly, it acts as a massive shock absorber. If a severe economic crisis hits, tuition-dependent universities have to freeze hiring/budgets, they panic. Harvard can rely on the sheer gravitational mass of its permanent capital to weather the storm, quietly scoop up the best faculty from struggling rivals, and just maintain its output without flinching.
Wow. And speaking of maintaining output, let's look at who actually gets to walk through those doors, because this is where all that financial resource meets raw human capital.
The admissions gauntlet.
Gauntlet is the right word. The admissions scarcity we are looking at is frankly staggering. For the incoming class of 2029, nearly 48,000 people applied. Only 2,003 were admitted.
So competitive.
That is roughly a 4.18% admit rate. Now, to be fair, once you are in, the financial access is incredible. As of the 2025-2026 academic year, Harvard College is totally free for students coming from families earning under $100,000 a year.
Which is amazing.
It is. But before you get in, there is a fierce data-driven debate about systemic advantage.
Oh, absolutely. The 2026 report leans heavily into recent causal research, specifically the landmark study by economists Raj Chetty, David Deming, and John Friedman on Ivy Plus institutions.
Right, the Chetty study.
Yeah, and the data in that study reveals that children from the top 1% of the income bracket have a massive admissions advantage compared to middle-class students who have the exact same SAT scores and academic profiles.
The exact same scores. That's wild.
And the mechanics of that advantage are laid out clearly. It is heavily tied to legacy preferences for children of alumni, recruited athletics, which often heavily favor expensive, country club sports like fencing or rowing.
Stuff that's hard for normal high schools to even offer.
Exactly. And non-academic ratings, which are the subjective personality and extracurricular scores where affluent applicants often heavily overperform.
So they are heavily subsidizing lower income students who actually make it through the door, but the pipeline leading up to the door is highly stratified by wealth. And the legal rules for how they are allowed to shape this incoming class completely shifted recently.
A massive shift.
We have to address the 2023 Students for Fair Admissions, or SFFA, Supreme Court decision. That ruling legally ended race-conscious admissions across the country. Harvard was forced into a major legal pivot. Now, according to the analysis, they have to rely on highly individualized, legally permissible considerations of a student's life experience and how that experience shaped them, rather than using race as a demographic category.
Yeah, that ruling fundamentally altered the admissions mechanics. It places the entire concept of holistic review under a legal microscope. The institution now has to pursue its goal of a diverse student body entirely through the lens of lived experience.
So like reading essays.
Right, reading essays about adversity, resilience, or unique backgrounds, all while ensuring they don't run afoul of the new constraints under Title VI. And Title VI is the federal civil rights law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in any program receiving federal financial assistance.
Which, as we noted earlier with the post-WWII shift, is a massive part of their operating model.
Billions of dollars are tied to it.
Right, because if you violate Title VI, you jeopardize that massive pipeline of federal research money. So they have secured the capital. And they have completely overhauled their admissions mechanics to navigate new legal constraints and select the brightest 4%. But how do they actually process these raw inputs into real-world influence? So what does this all mean for the final output?
Well, it changes the students into leaders.
The report dives into the signature pedagogical brands that Harvard literally exports to the globe. For example, let's look at the Harvard Business School. They use the famous case method. You aren't just sitting in a lecture hall taking notes.
Far from it.
You are dropped into a room with 90 extremely ambitious peers, cold called and forced to defend complex business decisions under intense uncertainty. I mean, that sounds terrifying.
It's basically a daily pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm.
And over at the Harvard Law School, they have historically pushed the casebook and Socratic method, mm-hmm. which is this relentless public testing of doctrinal reasoning.
Right.
The design of those teaching methods is highly intentional. It's not just about transferring facts from a textbook to a student's brain. The HBS case method and the HLS Socratic method act as high-pressure social crucibles.
Crucibles. I like that.
Yeah. They force future elites to develop a shared, highly specific vocabulary for managing risk, debating policy, and exercising authority.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they graduate, they don't just know the law or the market. They know exactly how to communicate with other people in power.
And that shared vocabulary feeds directly into the translation of faculty research. Because this isn't just theory staying locked in a library. Look at the numbers here. They are holding over 900 active technology licenses.
900.
That is knowledge moving straight from the lab into patented commercial tech. And you see the exact same translation in public policy. You have professors constantly rotating out of the classroom to sit on government advisory boards, shaping the actual public data sets and writing the frameworks that federal regulators use.
Which brings us to the ultimate output, the alumni network. What the analysis stresses is that elite reproduction in society isn't some smoky room conspiracy. It is a highly efficient, decentralized feedback loop.
Right, it's just the network doing its thing.
Exactly. You have 400,000 living alumni. They graduate and immediately enter the highest leverage sectors. Big law, Wall Street, the booming Boston biotech cluster, or public policy. The Harvard Kennedy School of Government is explicitly described in the research as operating a revolving door between academic analysis and government authority.
So they write a paper.
An expert writes a paper, gets appointed to a federal agency to implement it, and then returns to Harvard to teach the next generation. And all of their resulting societal success naturally feeds right back into Harvard's prestige and endowment.
I want to circle back to that charity study regarding the actual outcomes for these graduates, because it's easy to assume a massive selection effect. Think about it. If your admissions filter only catches the smartest, most fiercely driven 18-year-olds on the planet, those kids are going to be wildly successful, whether they go to Harvard, a great state school, or skip college entirely, right?
The selection effect is absolutely real. Decades of classic economic research show that much of the raw salary premium shrinks when you compare Ivy League graduates to people who are equally ambitious, had the same test scores, but attended strong public universities.
So the kid matters more than the school.
The drive of the individual matters immensely. However, the newer data from Chetty adds a vital, very specific caveat. While a brilliant student will do well anywhere, there's a measurable causal bump that Ivy Plus schools give specifically when it comes to reaching the top 1% of the income distribution and accessing elite, heavily gatekept employers.
So it's about the very top tier.
Yes. If you are a marginal candidate, the network pulls you over the wall.
It's all about the gatekeeping. Imagine you're an employer at an elite consulting firm staring at a stack of 500 identical perfect resumes. Is a Harvard degree less about the literal knowledge the student acquired in the textbooks and more like a highly efficient trust algorithm that instantly reduces the hiring risk for employers and investors?
Trust algorithm is a great way to put it. Economists refer to that specific dynamic as the signaling effect. An employer, an investor, or a political appointer cannot possibly evaluate the true underlying quality of every single candidate perfectly.
It's too time-consuming.
And risky.
Yeah.
The Harvard brand acts as a massive compression algorithm for information. It signals to the gatekeeper, this person has already survived our brutal 4% selection filter, they have been vetted by our faculty, and they speak our shared elite language.
Wow.
And the fascinating part is that this creates a self-fulfilling prophecy. The gatekeepers give them the prime opportunities based on that signal, which in turn guarantees the graduate's success, which validates the signal for the next generation.
The flywheel just keeps spinning. But having that unparalleled visibility being the absolute center of gravity for the American elite also makes Harvard uniquely vulnerable. It paints a massive target on its back for public, legal, and political stress.
Big time.
Now, as we transition to look at the recent pressures testing the system, we are going to touch on some highly sensitive, politically charged events from the last few years. And I want to pause here and speak directly to you, our listener. We are not taking any sides here. We do not endorse any viewpoints on these controversies. Our goal today is strictly to map out what the data and analysis in our 2026 source documents say about how these crises mechanically impacted the institution.
Right. And looking objectively at the timeline in the 2026 report, we see intense institutional turbulence following the Israel-Gaza war. The campus became a focal point for acute conflict, with various groups of students reporting that they experienced the environment as profoundly unsafe, hostile, or discriminatory.
This is a very intense period.
Highly intense. The mechanical response from the university was the creation of dedicated presidential task forces on both anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, and anti-Palestinian bias. Both of these bodies released their final, highly scrutinized reports in April of 2025.
And the fallout from that turbulence was multi-layered, threatening the very core of the flywheel we've been discussing. You had the federal government launching Title VI civil rights investigations. And as we established earlier, Title VI is tied directly to federal funding.
Right, the money.
This wasn't just a PR crisis. This was a severe tension between protecting free expression and ensuring campus safety, with billions of dollars on the line. In fact, in 2025, there was a major federal district court ruling where Harvard successfully challenged severe cuts to federal research funding that the government tried to impose as a penalty.
Which was a huge deal.
Massive. That ruling is currently under appeal, but it shows exactly how high the stakes got. The government went straight for the research engine.
The stakes also escalated to the highest levels of university governance. We saw the very public resignation of President Claudine Gay in January 2024. That followed highly publicized plagiarism allegations and intense congressional scrutiny regarding campus policies.
Right.
What this demonstrated mechanically is how reputational risk for an institution this prominent isn't isolated. It ripples immediately across faculty scholarship, board governance, and national political theater.
And compounding all of this intense political stress is a new, very tangible economic pressure. The 2026 report outlines that a federal endowment tax has steadily risen, hitting 8% for institutions in the top tier starting in fiscal year 2027.
8% is significant.
It is. We talked about how the endowment is a compounding engine of strategic patience. A tax increase of that size actively shaves down their compounding power year over year. So let's look at the board. They are under political fire, their federal research funding is being used as leverage, their endowment is being taxed heavier, and they are facing fierce competition for talent.
From places like Stanford and MIT.
Exactly. When you look at how the report compares Harvard to its rivals, it notes that Stanford often effortlessly wins out in West Coast tech and venture founder networks, while MIT utterly dominates in STEM and deep tech innovation. Harvard's play has always been its cross-sector breadth. It connects medicine, law, business, and policy into one hub. By trying to be the ultimate everything university, from law to medicine to the arts, does Harvard open itself up to national culture wars in a way that a laser-focused technical school like MIT just manages to avoid?
This raises an important question about the very nature of Harvard's influence. MIT's brand is heavily concentrated around objective scientific capability. Harvard's greatest asset, the core of its flywheel, is its centrality in American public life, law, and policy.
Right.
But that centrality is inherently a double-edged sword. When your core product is training the federal regulators, the Supreme Court justices, and the leading politicians, you inevitably become a proxy battleground for national class and cultural politics. You cannot be the primary architect of the American elite system and then expect to be ignored when the public is angry at that system.
That's a great point.
The friction is built into the business model.
Wow. Okay, bringing this all together, what we are really looking at isn't just a school, but a multi-capital conversion machine. Harvard Power is a system that continually takes raw economic wealth and converts it into cultural prestige. It takes specialized intellectual output from its labs and converts it into political access. And it takes exclusive social networks and converts them into institutional legitimacy. It is an endless, incredibly resilient cycle.
If we connect this to the bigger picture for you, the listener, understanding how Harvard operates isn't just about understanding one specific university in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It is an absolute masterclass in how elite power and influence are allocated, structured, and sustained in the modern world.
It really is.
By looking at their governance, their capital, and their signaling effects, you get a blueprint for how massive, complex systems endure across centuries.
It really is a masterclass. But I want to leave you with one final, deeply provocative thought inspired by the source material's outlook on the future. We've spent this entire time unpacking this incredible flywheel of knowledge, capital, and power. But the report flags a massive, looming disruption: artificial intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
Over the next 2 decades, if AI fully commoditizes access to elite classroom knowledge and research, I mean, imagine a world in 2045 where anyone, anywhere, can instantly access a perfectly synthesized, interactive version of the world's best lectures, legal frameworks, and scientific data.
The knowledge becomes ubiquitous.
Right. If the knowledge itself is essentially freer, will the historical concept of a university collapse entirely? Will institutions like Harvard stop pretending to be primarily about education and just evolve into pure, highly guarded identity and trust verification protocols for the global elite?
That's a wild thought.
It makes you wonder if that ivy-covered brick wall we talked about at the very beginning isn't actually hiding a school at all anymore. Maybe it's just becoming the world's most beautiful, well-funded security checkpoint. Something for you to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.